Words come to his mouth as he says them, and as he speaks, he knows he is doing the right thing. I do think you need help. Help I don't know how to give you. He takes a breath. I either want you to voluntarily commit yourself, or I want you to start seeing Dr. Lohman twice a week. He watches Jude for a long time. He can't tell what he's thinking. And what if I don't want to do either? Jude asks. Are you going to leave? He shakes his head. Jude, I love you, he says. But I can't condone this kind of behavior. I won't be able to stick around and watch you do this to yourself if I thought you'd interpret my presence as some sort of tacit approval. So, yes, I guess I would. Again they are quiet, and Jude turns over and lies on his back. If I tell you what happened to me, he begins, falteringly. If I tell you everything I can't discuss, if I tell you, Willem, do I still have to go? He looks at him, shakes his head again. Oh, Jude, he says. Yes, yes, you still have to. But I hope you'll tell me anyway. I really do. Whatever it is. Whatever it is. They are quiet once more, and this time their quiet turns to sleep. And the two of them fit into each other and sleep, until Willem hears Jude's voice speaking to him, and then he wakes, and he listens as Jude talks. It will take hours, because Jude is sometimes unable to continue, and Willem will wait and hold him so tightly that Jude won't be able to breathe. Twice he will try to wrench himself away, and Willem will pin him to the ground and hold him there until he calms himself. Because they are in the closet, they won't know what time it is, only that there has been a day that has arrived and departed, because they will have seen flat carpets of sun unroll themselves into the closet's doorways from the bedroom, from the bathroom. He will listen to stories that are unimaginable, that are abominable. He will excuse himself 3 times to go to the bathroom and study his face in the mirror and remind himself that he has only to find the courage to listen, although he will want to cover his ears and cover Jude's mouth to make the story cease. He will study the back of Jude's head because Jude can't face him and imagine the person he thinks he knows collapsing into rubble, clouds of dust gusting around him as nearby teams of artisans try to rebuild him in another material, in another shape, as a different person than the person who had stood for years and years. On and on and on the stories will go, and in their path will lie squalor, blood and bones and dirt and disease and misery. After Jude has finished telling him about his time with Brother Luke, Willem will ask him again if he enjoys having sex at all, even a little, even occasionally. And he will wait the many long minutes until Jude says he doesn't, that he hates it, that he always has. And he will nod, devastated, but relieved to have the real answer. And then he will ask him, not even knowing where the question has been hiding, if he's even attracted to men. And Jude will tell him, after a silence, that he's not certain, that he had always had sex with men, and so assumed he always would. Are you interested in having sex with women? He'll ask him, and he'll watch as, after another long silence, Jude shakes his head. No, he'll say. It's too late for me, Willem. And he will tell him it's not, that there are things they can do to help him. But Jude will shake his head again. No, he'll say. No, Willem. I've had enough. No more. And he will realize, as if slapped, the truth of this, and will stop. They will sleep again, and this time his dreams will be terrible. He will dream he is one of the men in the motel rooms. He will realize that he has behaved like one of them. He will wake with his nightmares, and it will be Jude who has to calm him. Finally, they will heave themselves from the floor. It will be Saturday afternoon, and they will have been lying in the closet since Thursday night, and shower and eat something, something hot and comforting, and then they will go directly from the kitchen into the study, where he will listen as Jude leaves a message for Dr. Lohman, whose card Willem has kept in his wallet all these years and produces magician-like within seconds, and from there to bed, and they will lie there, looking at each other, each afraid to ask the other. He to ask Jude to finish his story, Jude to ask him when he is leaving, because his leaving now seems an inevitability, a matter of logistics. On and on they stare, until Jude's face becomes almost meaningless as a face to him. It is a series of colors, of planes, of shapes that have been arranged in such a way to give other people pleasure, but to give its owner nothing. He doesn't know what he is going to do. He is dizzy with what he has heard, with comprehending the enormity of his misconceptions, with stretching his understanding past what is imaginable, with the knowledge that all of his carefully maintained edifices are now destroyed beyond repair. But for now, they are in their bed, in their room, in their apartment, and he reaches over and takes Jude's hand, holds it gently in his own. "You've told me about how you got to Montana," he hears himself saying. "So tell me, what happened next?" It was a time he rarely thought about, his flight to Philadelphia, because it was a period in which he had been so afloat from himself that even as he had lived his life, it had felt dreamlike and not quite real. There had been times in those weeks when he had opened his eyes and was genuinely unable to discern whether what had just happened had actually happened or whether he had imagined it. It had been a useful skill, this persistent and unshatterable somnambulism, and it had protected him. But then that ability, like his ability to forget, had abandoned him as well, and he was never to acquire it again. He had first noticed this suspension at the home. At nights, he would sometimes be awakened by one of the counselors, and he would follow them down to the office, where one of them was always on duty, and he would do whatever they wanted. After they were done, he would be escorted back to his room, a small space with a bunk bed that he shared with a mentally disabled boy, slow and fat and frightened-looking and prone to rages, whom he knew the counselors also sometimes took with them at night, and locked in again. There were a few of them the counselors used, but aside from his roommate, he didn't know who the other boys were, only that they existed. He was nearly mute in those sessions, and as he knelt or squatted or lay, he thought of a round clock face, its second hand gliding impassively around it, counting the revolutions until it ended. But he never begged, he never pled, he never bargained or made promises or cried. He didn't have the energy, he didn't have the conviction, not any longer, not anymore. It was a few months after his weekend with the Learys that he tried to run away. He had classes at the community college on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and on those days, one of the counselors would wait for him in the parking lot and drive him back to the home. He dreaded the end of classes. He dreaded the ride home. He never knew which counselor would be waiting for him, and when he reached the parking lot and saw who it was, his footsteps would sometimes slow. But it was as if he was a magnet, something controlled by ions, not will, and into the car he would be drawn. But one afternoon, this was in March, shortly before he turned 14, he had turned the corner and had seen the counselor, a man named Roger, who was the cruelest, the most demanding, the most vicious of them all, and he had stopped. For the first time in a long time, something in him resisted, and instead of continuing toward Roger, he had crept backward down the hallway, and then, once he was certain he was safely out of sight, he had run. He hadn't prepared for this, He had no plan, but some hidden, fiery part of him had, it seemed, been making observations as the rest of his mind sat cocooned in its thick, cottony slumber, and he found himself running toward the science lab, which was being renovated, and then, under a curtain of blue plastic tarp that shielded one exposed side of the building, and then worming into the 18 inches of space that separated the decaying interior wall from the new cement exterior that they were building around it. There was just enough room for him to wedge himself in, and he burrowed himself as deep into the space as he could, carefully working himself into a horizontal position, making sure his feet weren't visible. As he lay there, he tried to decide what he could do next. Roger would wait for him, and then when he didn't appear, they would eventually look for him. But if he could last here for the night, if he could wait until everything was silent around him, then he could escape. This was as far as he could think, although he was cognizant enough to realize that his chances were poor. He had no food, no money, and although it was only 5 in the afternoon, it was already very cold. He could feel his back and legs and palms, all the parts pressed against the stone, numbing themselves, could feel his nerves turning to thousands of pinpricks. But he could also feel, for the first time in months, his mind coming alert, could feel for the first time in years the giddy thrill of being able to make a decision, however poor or ill-conceived or unlikely. Suddenly the pinpricks felt like not a punishment, but a celebration, like hundreds of miniature fireworks exploding within him and for him, as if his body were reminding him of who he was and of what he still owned, himself. He lasted 2 hours before the security guard's dog found him, and he was dragged out by his feet, his palms scraping against the cement blocks he clung to even then, by this time so cold that he tripped as he walked, that his fingers were too iced to open the car door. And as soon as he was inside, Roger had turned around and hit him in the face, and the blood from his nose was thick and hot and reassuring, and the taste of it on his lips oddly nourishing, like soup, as if his body were something miraculous and self-healing, determined to save itself. That evening they had taken him to the barn, where they sometimes took him at night, and beat him so badly that he had blacked out almost immediately after it had begun. He had been hospitalized that night, and then again a few weeks later, when the wounds had gotten infected. For those weeks, he had been left alone, and although they had been told at the hospital that he was a delinquent, that he was troubled, that he was a problem and a liar, the nurses were kind to him. There was one, an older woman, who had sat by his bed and held a glass of apple juice with a straw in it so he could sip from it without lifting his head. He'd had to lie on his side so they could clean his back and drain the wounds. "I don't care what you did," she told him one night after she had changed his bandages. "No one deserves this. Do you hear me, young man?" "Then help me," he wanted to say. "Please help me." But he didn't. He was too ashamed. She sat next to him again and put her hand on his forehead. "Try to behave yourself, all right," she had said, but her voice had been gentle. "I don't want to see you back here. Help me," he wanted to say again as she left the room. "Please, please." But he couldn't. He never saw her again. Later, as an adult, he would wonder if he had invented this nurse, if he had conjured her out of desperation, a simulacrum of kindness that was almost as good as the real thing. He would argue with himself. If she had existed, truly existed, wouldn't she have told someone about him? Wouldn't someone have been sent to help him? But his memories from this period were something slightly blur-edged and unreliable, and as the years went by, he was to come to realize that he was, always, trying to make his life, his childhood, into something more acceptable, something more normal. He would startle himself from a dream about the counselors and would try to comfort himself. "There were only 2 of them who used you," he would tell himself. "Maybe 3. The others didn't. They weren't all cruel to you. And then he would try, for days, to remember how many there had actually been. Was it two? Or was it three? For years, he couldn't understand why this was so important to him, why it mattered to him so much, why he was always trying to argue against his own memories, to spend so much time debating the details of what had happened. And then he realized that it was because he thought that if he could convince himself that it was less awful than he remembered, then he could also convince himself that he was less damaged, that he was closer to healthy than he feared he was. Finally, he was sent back to the home, and the first time he had seen his back, he had recoiled, moving so quickly away from the bathroom mirror that he had slipped and fallen on a section of wet tile. In those initial weeks after the beating, when the scar tissue was still forming, it had made a puffed mound of flesh on his back, and at lunch he would sit alone, and the older boys would whip damp pellets of napkin at it, trying to get them to ping off of it as against a target, cheering when they hit him. Until that point, he had never thought too specifically about his appearance. He knew he was ugly. He knew he was ruined. He knew he was diseased. But he had never considered himself grotesque. But now he was. There seemed to be an inevitability to this, to his life, that every year he would become worse, more disgusting, more depraved. Every year his right to humanness diminished. Every year he became less and less of a person. But he didn't care any longer. He couldn't allow himself to. It was difficult to live without caring, however, and he found himself curiously unable to forget Brother Luke's promise that when he was 16, his old life would stop and his new life would begin. He knew, he did, that Brother Luke had been lying, but he couldn't stop thinking about it. 16, he would think to himself at night. 16. When I am 16, this will end. He had asked Brother Luke once what their life would be like after he turned 16. "You'll go to college," Luke had said, immediately, and he had thrilled to this. He had asked where he would go, and Luke had named the college he had attended as well, although when he had gotten to that college after all, he had looked up Brother Luke, Edgar Wilmot, and had realized there was no record of him having ever attended the school, and he had been relieved, relieved to not have something in common with the brother, although it was he who had let him imagine that he might someday be there. "I'll move to Boston too," Luke said, "and we'll be married, so we'll live in an apartment off campus." Sometimes they discussed this, the courses he would take, the things Brother Luke had done when he was at college, the places they would travel to after he graduated. "Maybe we'll have a son together one day," Luke said once, and he had stiffened, for he knew without Luke saying so that Luke would do to this phantom son of theirs what had been done to him, and he remembered thinking that this would never happen, that he would never let this ghost child, this child who didn't exist, ever exist, that he would never let another child be around Luke. He remembered thinking that he would protect this son of theirs, and for a brief, awful moment, he wished he would never turn 16 at all, because he knew that once he did, Luke would need someone else, and that he couldn't let that happen. But now Luke was dead. The phantom child was safe. He could safely turn 16. He could turn 16 and be safe. The months passed. His back healed. Now a security guard waited for him after his classes and walked him to the parking lot to wait for the counselor on duty. One day at the end of the fall semester, his math professor talked to him after class had ended. Had he thought about college yet? He could help him. He could help him get there. He could go somewhere excellent, somewhere top flight. And oh, he wanted to go. He wanted to get away. He wanted to go to college. He was tugged in those days between trying to resign himself to the fact that his life would forevermore be what it was, and the hope, small and stupid and stubborn as it was, that it could be something else. The balance between resignation and hope shifted by the day, by the hour, sometimes by the minute. He was always, always trying to decide how he should be, if his thoughts should be of acceptance or of escape. In that moment, he had looked at his professor, but as he was about to answer, "Yes, yes, help me," something stopped him. The professor had always been kind to him, but wasn't there something about that kindness that made him resemble Brother Luke? What if the professor's offer of help cost him? He argued with himself as the professor waited for his answer. "One more time won't hurt you," said the desperate part of him, the part that wanted to leave, the part that was counting every day until 16, the part the other part of him jeered at. "It's one more time. He's another client. Now is not the time to start getting proud." But in the end, he had ignored that voice. He was so tired, he was so sore, he was so exhausted from being disappointed, and had shaken his head. "College isn't for me," he told the professor, his voice thin from the strain of lying. "Thank you, but I don't need your help." "I think you're making a big mistake, Jude," said his professor, after a silence. "Promise me you'll reconsider." And he had reached out and touched his arm, and he had jerked away, and the professor had looked at him strangely, and he had turned and fled the room, the hallway blurring into planes of beige. That night he was taken to the barn. The barn was no longer a working barn, but a place to store the shop classes and the auto repair classes' projects. In the stalls were half-assembled carburetors and hulls of half-repaired trucks and half-sanded rocking chairs that the home sold for money. He was in the stall with the rocking chairs, and as one of the counselors seesawed into him, he left himself and flew above the stalls to the rafters of the barn, where he paused, looking at the scene below him, the machinery and furniture like alien sculpture, the floor dusty with dirt and the stray pieces of hay, reminders of the barn's original life that they never seemed able to fully erase, at the two people making a strange, eight-legged creature, one silent, one noisy and grunting and thrusting and alive. And then he was flying out of the round window cut high into the wall and over the home, over its fields that were so beautiful and green and yellow with wild mustard in the summer, and now in December were still beautiful in their own way, a shimmering expanse of lunar white, the snow so fresh and new that no one had yet trampled it. He flew above this all, and across landscapes he had read about but had never seen, across mountains so clean that they made him feel clean just to contemplate them, over lakes as big as oceans, until he was floating above Boston, and circling down and down to that series of buildings that trimmed the side of the river, an expansive ring of structures punctuated by squares of green, where he would go and be remade, and where his life would begin, where he could pretend that everything that had come before had been someone else's life, or a series of mistakes, never to be discussed, never to be examined. When he came back to himself, the counselor was on top of him, asleep. His name was Colin, and he was often drunk, as he was tonight, his hot, yeasty breath puffing against his face. He was naked. Colin was wearing a sweater, but nothing else, and for a while he lay there under Colin's weight, breathing too, waiting for him to wake so he could be returned to his bedroom and cut himself. And then, unthinkingly, almost as if he was a marionette, his limbs moving without thought, he was wriggling out from beneath Colin, quiet and quick, and hurrying his clothes back on, and then again, before he knew it, grabbing Colin's puffed coat from the hook on the inside of the stall and shrugging it on. Colin was much larger than he was, fatter and more muscular, but he was almost as tall, and it was less wieldy than it looked. And then he was grabbing Colin's jeans from the ground and snatching out his wallet, and then the money within it, He didn't count how much it was, but he could tell by how thin a sheaf it was that it wasn't much, and shoving that into his own jeans pocket, and then he was running. He had always been a good runner, swift and silent and certain. Watching him at the track, Brother Luke had always said he must be part Mohican. And now he ran out of the barn, its doors open to the sparkling, hushed night, looking about him as he left, and then, seeing no one, toward the field behind the home's dormitory. It was half a mile from the dormitory to the road, and although he would normally have been in pain after what happened in the barn, that night he felt no pain, only elation, a sense of hyper-wakefulness that seemed to have been conjured particularly for this night, for this adventure. At the edge of the property he dropped to the ground and rolled carefully under the barbed wire, wrapping Colin's jacket sleeves around his hands and then holding the coils of wire above him so he could scoot beneath them. Once he was safely free, his elation only intensified, and he ran and ran in the direction he knew was east, toward Boston, away from the home, from the west, from everything. He knew he would eventually have to leave this road, which was narrow and mostly dirt, and move toward the highway, where he would be more exposed, but also more anonymous. And he moved quickly down the hill that led toward the black, dense woods that separated the road from the interstate. Running on grass was more difficult, but he did so anyway, keeping close to the edge of the forest so that if a car passed, he could duck within it and hide behind a tree. As an adult, as a crippled adult, and then as a crippled adult who was truly crippled, as someone who could no longer even walk, as someone for whom running was a magic trick, as impossible as flying, he would look back on that night with awe. How fleet he had been, how fast, how tireless, how lucky. He would wonder how long he had run that night. At least 2 hours, he thought, maybe three. Although at the time he hadn't thought about that at all, only that he needed to get as far as he could from the home. The sun began to appear in the sky, and he ran into the woods, which were the source of many of the younger boys' fears, and which were so crowded and lightless that even he was frightened, and he was not frightened in general by nature. But he had gone as deep into them as he could, both because he had to go through the woods to reach the interstate, and because he knew that the deeper he hid within them, the less likely he was to be discovered. And finally, he had chosen a large tree, one of the largest, as if its size offered some promise of reassurance, as if it would guard and protect him, and had tucked himself between its roots and slept. When he woke, it was dark again, although whether it was late afternoon or late evening or early morning, he wasn't certain. He began moving his way through the trees again, humming to comfort himself and to announce himself to whatever might be waiting for him, to show them he was unafraid. And by the time he had been spat out by the woods on the other side, it was still dark. So he knew it was in fact nighttime, and he had slept all day. And that knowledge made him feel stronger and more energetic. "Sleep is more important than food," he remonstrated himself, because he was very hungry. And then to his legs, "Move!" And he did, running again uphill toward the interstate. He had realized at some point in the forest that there was only one way he would be able to get to Boston, and so he stood by the side of the road, and when the first truck stopped for him and he climbed aboard, he knew what he would have to do when the truck stopped, and he did it. He did it again and again and again. Sometimes the drivers gave him food or money, and sometimes they didn't. They all had little nests they had made for themselves in the trailers of their trucks, and they lay there, and sometimes after it was over, they would drive him a little farther, and he would sleep, the world moving beneath him in a perpetual earthquake. At filling stations, he would buy things to eat and would wait around, and eventually someone would choose him, someone always did, and he would climb into the truck. "Where are you headed?" they would ask him. "Boston," he would say. "My uncle's there." Sometimes he felt the shame of what he was doing so intensely he wanted to vomit. He knew he would never be able to claim to himself that he had been coerced. He'd had sex with these men freely. He had let them do whatever they wanted. He had performed enthusiastically and well. And sometimes he was unsentimental. He was doing what he had to do. There was no other way. This was his skill, his one great skill, and he was using it to get somewhere better. He was using himself to save himself. Sometimes the men would want him for longer, and they would get a motel room, and he would imagine Brother Luke waiting in the bathroom for him. Sometimes they would talk to him. "I have a son your age," they'd say. "I have a daughter your age." And he would lie there and listen. Sometimes they would watch television until they were ready to go again. Some of them were cruel to him. Some of them made him fear he would be killed or hurt so badly he wouldn't be able to escape. And in those moments, he would be terrified, and he would wish desperately for Brother Luke, for the monastery, for the nurse who had been so kind to him. But most of them were neither cruel nor kind. They were clients, and he was giving them what they wanted. Years later, when he was able to review these weeks more objectively, he would be dumbstruck by how stupid he had been, by how small his oculus. Why hadn't he simply escaped? Why hadn't he taken the money he had earned and bought a bus ticket? He would try and try to remember how much he had earned, and although he knew it hadn't been much, he thought that it might have been enough for a ticket somewhere, anywhere, even if not Boston. But then, it simply hadn't occurred to him. It was as if the entire store of resourcefulness he had possessed, every piece of courage, had been spent on his flight from the home. And once on his own, he had simply let his life be dictated to him by others, following one man after the next, the way he had been taught to do. And of all the ways in which he changed himself as an adult, it would be this idea that he could create at least some part of his own future that would be the most difficult lesson to learn, as well as the most rewarding. Once there had been a man who had smelled so terribly and had been so sweatily large that he had almost changed his mind, but although the sex had been horrific, the man had been gentle with him afterward, had bought him a sandwich and a soda, and had asked him real questions about himself, and had listened carefully to his made-up answers. He had stayed with the man for 2 nights, and as he drove, the man had listened to bluegrass music and had sung along. He had had a lovely voice, low and clear, and he had taught him the words, and he had found himself singing along with this man, the road smooth beneath them. "God, you have a nice voice, Joey," the man had said. And he had, how weak he was, how pathetic, allowed himself to be warmed by this comment, had gobbled up this affection as a rat would a piece of molding bread. On the second day, the man had asked him if he wanted to stay with him. They were in Ohio, and unfortunately he wasn't going any farther east. He was headed south now. But if he wanted to stay with him, he would be delighted. He would make sure he was taken care of. He had declined the man's offer, and the man had nodded, as if he had expected he would, and given him a fold of money and kissed him, the first of them who had. "Good luck to you, Joey," he said. And later, after the man had left, he had counted the money and realized it was more than he thought. It was more than he'd made in his previous 10 days altogether. Later, when the next man was brutish, when he was violent and rough, he had wished he had gone with the other man. Suddenly, Boston seemed less important than tenderness, than someone who would protect him and be good to him. He lamented his poor choices, how he seemed unable to appreciate the people who were actually decent to him. He thought again of Brother Luke, how Luke had never hit him or yelled at him, how he had never called him names. Somewhere he had gotten sick, but he didn't know if it was from his time on the road or from the home. He made the men use condoms, but a few of them had said they would and then hadn't, and he had struggled and shouted, but there had been nothing he could do. He knew from past experience that he would need a doctor. He stank. He was in so much pain he could barely walk. On the outskirts of Philadelphia, he decided he'd take a break. He had to. He had torn a small hole in the sleeve of Colin's jacket and had rolled his money into a tube and shoved it inside, and then closed the hole with a safety pin he had found in one of the motel rooms. He climbed out of the last truck, although at the time he hadn't known it would be the last truck. At the time he had thought, one more. One more and I'll make it to Boston. He hated that he had to stop now when he was so close, but he knew he needed help. He had waited as long as he could. The driver had stopped at a filling station near Philadelphia. He didn't want to drive into the city. There, he made his slow way to the bathroom. He tried to clean himself. The illness made him tired. He had a fever. The last thing he remembered from that day, it had been late January, he thought. Still cold, and now with a wet, stinging wind that seemed to slap against him, was walking to the edge of the gas station, where there had been a small tree, barren and unloved and alone, and sitting down against it, resting his back in Colin's now filthy jacket against its spindly, unconvincing trunk, and shutting his eyes, hoping that, if he slept for a while, he might feel at least a little stronger. When he woke, he knew he was in the back seat of a car, and the car was moving, and there was Schubert playing, and he allowed himself to be comforted by that, because it was something he knew, something familiar in such unfamiliarity, in a strange car being driven by a stranger he was too weak to sit up and examine, through a strange landscape to an unknown destination. When he woke again, he was in a room, a living room, and he looked around him, at the sofa he was on, the coffee table in front of it, two armchairs, a stone fireplace, all in shades of brown. He stood, still dizzy but less dizzy, and as he did, he noticed there was a man standing in a doorway, watching him. A man a little shorter than he, and thin, but with a sloping stomach and fertile, swelling hips. He had glasses that had black plastic bracketing their top half, but were clear glass beneath, and a tonsure of hair trimmed very short and soft, like a mink's coat. "Come to the kitchen and have something to eat," the man said in a quiet, toneless voice, and he did, walking slowly after him and into a kitchen that, except for its tiles and walls, was also brown. Brown table, brown cupboards, brown chairs. He sat in the chair at the foot of the table, and the man put a plate before him with a hamburger and a side of fries, a glass filled with milk. "I normally don't get fast food," the man said, and looked at him. He wasn't sure what to say.
"Thank you,"
he said, and the man nodded. "Eat," he said, and he did, and the man sat at the head of the table and watched him. Normally this would have made him self-conscious, but he was too hungry to care this time. When he was finished, he sat back and thanked the man again, and the man nodded again, and there was a silence. "You're a prostitute," the man said, and he flushed and looked down at the table at its shined brown wood.
"Yes,"
he admitted. The man made a little noise, a little snuffle. "How long have you been a prostitute?" he asked, but he couldn't answer him and was silent. "Well," the man asked, "2 years, 5 years, 10 years, your whole life?" He was impatient, or almost impatient, but his voice was soft, and he wasn't yelling.
"5 years,"
he said, and the man made the same small noise again. "You have a venereal disease," the man said. "I can smell it on you." And he cringed and bent his head and nodded. The man sighed. "Well," he said, "you're in luck, because I'm a doctor, and I happen to have some antibiotics in the house." He got up and padded over to one of the cupboards and came back with an orange plastic bottle and took out a pill. "Take this," he said, and he did. "Finish your milk," the man said, and he did, and then the man left the room and he waited until he came back. "Well," the man said, "follow me." He did, his legs stringy beneath him, and followed the man to a door across from the living room, which the man unlocked and held open for him. He hesitated, and the man made an impatient clucking noise. "Go on," he said. "It's a bedroom." And he shut his eyes, weary, and then opened them again. He began preparing himself for the man to be cruel. The quiet ones always were. When he reached the doorway, he saw that it led to a basement, and there was a set of wooden steps, steep like a ladder, that he would have to descend. And he paused once more, wary, and the man made his strange, insect-like sound again, and shoved him, not hard, against the small of his back, and he stumbled down the stairs. He had been expecting a dungeon, slippery and leaking and dank, but it really was a bedroom, with a mattress made up with a blanket and sheets and a blue circular rug beneath it, and lining the left-hand wall, bookcases of the same unfinished wood the staircase had been made from, with books on them. The space was bright lit in that aggressive, relentless way he remembered from hospitals and police stations, and there was a small window about the size of a dictionary, cut high into the far wall. "I put out some clothes for you," the man said, and he saw that folded on the mattress was a shirt and a pair of sweatpants, and a towel and toothbrush as well. "The bathroom's there," the man said, pointing to the far right-hand corner of the room. And then he began to leave.
"Wait,"
he called after the man, and the man stopped his climb and looked at him, and he began, under the man's gaze, to unbutton his shirt. Something changed in the man's face then, and he climbed another few steps. "You're sick," he said. "You have to get better first." And then he left the room, the door clicking shut after him. He slept that night, both from lack of anything else to do and from exhaustion. The next morning he woke and smelled food, and he groaned to his feet and walked slowly up the stairs, where he found a plastic tray with a plate of eggs, poached, and two lengths of bacon, a roll, a glass of milk, a banana, and another of the white pills. He was too wobbly to bring it down without falling, and so he sat there, on one of the unfinished wooden steps, and ate the food and swallowed the pill. After resting, he stood to open the door and take the tray to the kitchen, but the knob wouldn't turn because the door was locked. There was a small square cut into the bottom of the door, a cat door, he assumed, although he hadn't seen a cat, and he held back its curtain of rubber and poked his head out. "Hello?" he called. He realized he didn't know the man's name, which wasn't unusual. He never knew their names. "Sir? Hello?" But there was no answer, and he could tell from the way the house was silent that he was alone. He should have felt panic. He should have felt fear. But he felt neither, only a crush of tiredness, and he left the tray at the top of the stairs and worked his way slowly down again, and then into bed, where he slept once more. He dozed for that entire day, and when he woke, the man was standing above him again, watching him, and he sat up abruptly. "Dinner," the man said, and he followed him upstairs, still in his borrowed clothes, which were too wide in the waist and too short in the sleeves and legs, because when he had looked for his own clothes, they were missing. "My money," he thought, but he was too addled to think beyond that. Once again, he sat in the brown kitchen, and the man brought him his pill and a plate with brown meatloaf and a slop of mashed potatoes and broccoli and another plate for himself, and they began to eat in silence. Silence didn't make him nervous. Usually he was grateful for it. But this man's silence was closer to inwardness, the way a cat will be silent and watching, watching, watching so fixedly that you don't know what it sees, and then suddenly it will jump and trap something beneath its paw. "What kind of doctor are you?" he asked, tentatively, and the man looked at him. "A psychiatrist," the doctor said. "Do you know what that is?" "Yes," he said. The man made his noise again. Do you like being a prostitute? He asked, and he felt, unaccountably, tears in his eyes. But then he blinked and they were gone.
No,
he said. Then why do you do it? The man asked, and he shook his head. Speak, the man said.
I don't know,
he said, and the man made a huffing noise.
It's what I know how to do,
he said at last. Are you good at it? The man asked, and once again he felt that sting, and he was quiet for a long time.
Yes,
he said, and it was the worst admission he had ever made, the hardest word for him to say. After they were done, the doctor escorted him once again to the door and gave him the same little shove inside.
Wait,
he said to the man as he was closing the door.
My name's Joey.
And when the man said nothing, only stared at him.
What's yours?
The man kept looking at him, but now he was, he thought, almost smiling, or at least he was about to make some sort of expression. But then he didn't. Dr. Traylor, the man said, and then pulled the door quickly shut behind him, as if that very information was a bird that might fly away if it too were not trapped inside with him. The next day he felt less sore, less febrile. When he stood, though, he realized he was still weak, and he swayed and grabbed at the air, and in the end he didn't fall. He moved toward the bookshelves, examining the books, which were paperbacks, swollen and buckling from heat and moisture and smelling sweetly of mildew. He found a copy of Emma, which he had been reading in class at the college before he ran away, and carried the book slowly up the stairs with him, where he found the place he'd left off and read as he ate his breakfast and took his pill. This time there was a sandwich as well, wrapped in a paper towel, with the word lunch written on the towel in small letters. After he had eaten, he went downstairs with the book and sandwich and lay in bed, and he was reminded of how much he had missed reading, of how grateful he was for this opportunity to leave behind his life. He slept again, woke again. By evening he was very tired, and some of the pain had returned, and when Dr. Traylor held open the door for him, it took him a long time to mount the stairs. At dinner he didn't say anything, and neither did Dr. Traylor, but when he offered to help Dr. Traylor with the dishes or the cooking, Dr. Traylor had looked at him. You're sick, he said.
I'm better, he said. I can help you in the kitchen if you want.
No, I mean you're sick, Dr. Traylor said. You're diseased. I can't have a diseased person touching my food. And he had looked down, humiliated. There was a silence. Where are your parents? Dr. Traylor asked, and he shook his head again. Speak, Dr. Traylor said, and this time he was impatient, although he still hadn't raised his voice.
I don't know,
he stammered.
I never had any.
How did you become a prostitute? Dr. Traylor asked. Did you start yourself, or did someone help you do it? He swallowed, feeling the food in his stomach turning to paste.
Someone help me,
he whispered. There was a silence. You don't like it when I call you a prostitute, the man said, and he managed this time to raise his head and look at him.
No,
he said. I understand, the man said, but that is what you are, isn't it? Although I could call you something else if you like. A whore, maybe. He was quiet again. Is that better?
No,
he whispered again. So, the man said, a prostitute it is then, right? And looked at him, and finally he nodded. That night in the bedroom, he looked for something to cut himself with, but there was nothing sharp in the room, nothing at all. Even the books had only soft, bloated pages. So he pressed his fingernails into his calves as hard as he could, bent over and wincing from the effort and discomfort, and finally he was able to puncture the skin and then work his nail back and forth in the cut to make it wider. He was only able to make 3 incisions in his right leg, and then he was too tired, and he fell asleep again. The 3rd morning he felt demonstrably better, stronger, more alert. He ate his breakfast and read his book, and then he moved the tray aside and stuck his head through the flat cutout and tried to fit his shoulders through it. But no matter what angle he tried, he was simply too large and the opening too small, and at last he had to stop. After he had rested, he poked his head through the hole again. He had a direct view of the living room to his left and the kitchen area to his right, and he looked and looked as if for clues. The house was very tidy. He could tell from how tidy it was that Dr. Traylor lived alone. If he craned his neck, he could see, on the far left, a staircase leading to a 2nd story, and just beyond that, the front door, but he couldn't see how many locks it had. Mainly, though, the house was defined by its silence. There was no ticking of clocks, no sound of cars or people outside. It could have been a house zooming through space, so quiet was it. The only noise was the refrigerator, purring its intermittent whir, but when it stopped, the silence was absolute. But as featureless as the house was, he was also fascinated by it. It was only the 3rd house he had ever been in. The 2nd had been the Learys. The 1st house had been a client, a very important client, Brother Luke had told him, outside Salt Lake City, who had paid extra because he didn't want to come to the motel room. That house had been enormous, all sandstone and glass, and Brother Luke had come with him and had secreted himself in the bathroom, a bathroom as big as one of their motel rooms, off the bedroom where he and the client had had sex. Later, as an adult, he would fetishize houses, especially his own house. Although even before he had Green Street or Lantern House or the flat in London, he would treat himself every few months to a magazine about homes, about people who spent their lives making pretty places even prettier, and he would turn the pages slowly, studying every picture. His friends laughed at him for this, but he didn't care. He dreamed of the day he'd have some place of his own, with things that were absolutely his. That night, Dr. Traylor let him out again. And again, it was the kitchen and the meal and the 2 of them eating in silence.
"I feel better now," he ventured.
And then, when Dr. Traylor didn't say anything,
"If you want to do something."
He was realistic enough to know that he wasn't going to be allowed to leave without repaying Dr. Traylor in some way. He was hopeful enough to think that he might be allowed to leave at all. But Dr. Traylor shook his head. "You may feel better, but you're still diseased," he said. "The antibiotics take 10 days to eliminate the infection." He took a fish bone, so fine it was translucent, out of his mouth, placed it on the edge of his plate. "Don't tell me this is the first venereal disease you've ever had," he said, looking up at him, and he flushed again. That night he thought about what to do. He was almost strong enough to run, he thought. At the next dinner, he would follow Dr. Traylor, and then when his back was turned, he would run to the door and outside and look for help. There were some problems with his plan. He still didn't have his clothes. He didn't have any shoes. But he knew that there was something wrong with this house, that there was something wrong with Dr. Traylor, that he had to get out. He tried to conserve his energy the next day. He was too twitchy to read, and he had to keep himself from pacing the floor. He saved that day's sandwich and stuffed it into the pocket of the borrowed sweatpants so he would have something to eat if he had to hide for a long period. In the other pocket, he shoved the plastic bag that lined the trash can in the bathroom. He thought he could tear it in half and make shoes for himself once he was safely out of Dr. Traylor's reach. And then he waited. But that night he wasn't let out of the room at all. From his perch near the flap, he could see the living room lights turning on. He could smell food cooking.
"Dr. Traylor?" he called. Hello?
But there was silence, except for the sound of meat frying in a pan, the evening's news on the television.
Dr. Traylor!
He called.
Please! Please!
But nothing happened, and after calling and calling, he was spent and slumped back down the stairs. That night he had a dream that on the upper floor of the house was a series of other bedrooms, all with low beds and round, tufted rugs beneath them, and that each bed held a boy. Some of the boys were older, because they had been in the house for a long time, and some were younger. None of them knew that the others existed. None of them could hear one another. He realized that he didn't know the physical dimensions of the house, and in the dream the house became a skyscraper, filled with hundreds of rooms, of cells, each containing a different boy, each waiting for Dr. Traylor to let him out. He woke then, gasping, and ran to the top of the stairs, but when he pushed against the flap, it didn't move. He lifted it up and saw that the hole had been closed with a piece of gray plastic, and as hard as he pushed against it, it wouldn't budge. He didn't know what to do. He tried to stay up the rest of the night, but he fell asleep, and when he woke, there was the tray with his breakfast and his lunch and two pills, one for the morning, one for evening. He pinched the pills between his fingers and considered them. If he didn't take them, he wouldn't get better, and Dr. Traylor wouldn't touch him unless he was well. But if he didn't take them, then he wouldn't get better, and he knew from prior experience how awful he would feel, how almost unimaginably filthy he would be, as if his entire self, inside and out, had been sprayed with excrement. He began to rock himself then.
What do I do? He asked. What do I do?
He thought of the fat truck driver, the one who had been kind to him.
Help me, he begged him. Help me, Brother Luke,
he pled.
Help me. Help me.
Once again, he thought, I have made the wrong decision. I have left somewhere where I at least had the outdoors and school and where I knew what was going to happen to me. And now I have none of those things. You're so stupid, the voice inside him said. You're so stupid. For 6 more days it went on like this. His food would appear sometime when he was sleeping. He took the pills. He couldn't not. On the 10th day, the door opened, and Dr. Traylor was standing there. He was so alarmed, so surprised, that he hadn't been prepared. But before he could stand, Dr. Traylor had closed the door and was coming toward him. Over one shoulder he held an iron fire poker, loosely, as one would a baseball bat, and as he came toward him he was terrified by it. What did it mean? What would be done to him with it? Take off your clothes, Dr. Traylor said, still in his same bland voice, and he did, and Dr. Traylor swung the poker off his shoulder, and he ducked, reflexively, lifting his arms over his head. He heard the doctor make his small, wet noise, and then Dr. Traylor unbelted his pants and stood before him. Take them down, he said, and he did. But before he was able to begin, Dr. Traylor nudged him in the neck with the poker. You try anything, he said. Biting, anything. And I will beat you in the head with this until you become a vegetable. Do you understand me? He nodded, too petrified to say anything.
Speak!
Dr. Traylor yelled, and he startled.
Yes, he gulped. Yes, I understand.
He was scared of Dr. Traylor, of course. He was scared of all of them. But it had never occurred to him to fight with the clients, had never occurred to him to challenge them. They were powerful, and he was not. And Brother Luke had trained him too well. He was too obedient. He was, as Dr. Traylor had made him admit, a good prostitute. Every day was like this. And although the sex was no worse than what he'd had before, he remained convinced that it was a prelude, that it would eventually get very bad, very